Well, today is the first Sunday after Easter. And in the midst of the life of the church, in the midst of our community, we are still living in the midst of a miracle. We are people who have just experienced the miracle of Jesus dying, being placed in a tomb, and then escaping from that tomb, escaping from death, having a successful triumph of victory over death, and raising again. Jesus is alive forevermore, and we are still finding ourselves in the midst of that story. Our scripture verse this morning comes from us from the Gospel of John in the 20th chapter. And it's the story of one of Jesus' disciples, Thomas, and how he finds himself after the miracle has happened. Hear these words from the Gospel of John. But Thomas, who was called the twin, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the mark of the nails in his hands and put my finger in the mark of the nails and my hand in his sides, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were again in the house, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were shut, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out and put it in my side. Do not doubt, but believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet come to believe." Have you ever had an experience of something that you've been told, but you don't quite believe it? It's those moments in life when something surprises you or catches you off guard and you say, "No way. Malarkey. Pish posh. When pigs fly," right? Those kind of moments. I had one of those the other day when I picked up my son from daycare and I was reading through the piece of paper where we get a report of his day, how many times he tried to go potty and what he ate and whether they went outside to play and what kind of puzzles or games or books he enjoyed that day. And on the piece of paper, it said, "Michael, my son, ate all of his peas and corn today." Exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point, and a little yellow smiley face sticker next to it. The teachers could hardly believe it, and I could hardly believe it. I said, "No way, not my kid. He doesn't eat peas and corn. Never in his life. Green beans, maybe. Cheetos, yes. But peas and corn, no way." And I got home and I told his dad, I told Joel, my husband, and I said, "Guess what Michael did at school today? He ate all his peas and corn." Joel says, "Yeah, miracle of miracles. Believe that when I see it." There are stories in life that we're told that we don't always believe until we see it. And this is one of those stories where we find Thomas and the disciples. They were 12 people who had this amazing experience of learning from Jesus throughout his earthly ministry, of walking with him and talking with him, of eating with him. Thomas had been there. He was in the upper room on Thursday night. He enjoyed the Last Supper with Jesus. He watched Jesus break the bread and serve the wine. He sat down and slipped off his sandals so that Jesus could wipe his feet. He heard Jesus' last message, "To love thy neighbor." He was there for all of it. He watched Jesus die on the cross. He watched from afar. And then somewhere on Holy Saturday and Easter Sunday, we don't get a lot of a glimpse of what Thomas was doing. We're left to fill in the gaps ourselves. Those questions remain. Where was Thomas, and why wasn't he with the disciples? Where could he have gone, and what could have been more important? Things. What more important things could he have had to do that day? In my head, I imagine that maybe Thomas was an introvert. Maybe he had had enough people time, and the events of Maundy Thursday and Good Friday were so much for him that he needed some peace and quiet. Maybe he needed to go grieve away somewhere privately, away from his people, by himself, so that he could scream and so that he could cry, so that he could have that sort of overwhelming flood of emotions that we have after we watch something very painful transpire. Maybe Thomas needed to go and process what he had heard with someone else who wasn't there. Maybe he was someone who verbally processes events, and he needed to go and find someone and try to rationalize the situation and say, this is what I think I saw, but I'm not sure if it was real. This is what I think I heard, but I'm not entirely positive if I got it all right. This is how Thomas earns himself the name of the doubting disciple. In other places, in other gospels, he's called the disciple who is faithless. He's called Doubting Thomas. And when Jesus addresses him, Thomas kind of shows up as a skeptic. Thomas couldn't wrap his head around the miracle and the mystery of Jesus' death and resurrection. He doubted the validity of the whole story he was being told. He wanted a rational explanation, some solid evidence, like CSI kind of stuff that you put in a Ziploc bag and label with the capital T, truth. That's what Thomas was after. The disciples finally catch up to him a week after Jesus had been released from the tomb and was raised from the dead. He ascended into heaven, and the disciples catch up to Thomas, and they reveal the good news to him. They say, hey, dude, I don't know where you've been, but we have seen the Lord. It's been kind of a busy week around here. And Thomas can't believe it. He's a skeptic. He's the one saying, no way, pish-posh, malarkey. That can't be true when pigs fly. Thomas can't wrap his head around why Jesus would want to come back to life and save all of humankind. Why would Jesus want to save someone like me, he thought. He probably doesn't even remember me. I'm not worthy of all that love, of all that grace, of all that forgiveness. My life, I'm not even sure if it can be resurrected, Thomas thinks to himself. I don't deserve the gift that Jesus is giving me. I'm going to push it away. I've made so many mistakes. I've stooped so far down. It's not even possible for Jesus, the man who raised from the dead, to save someone like me. This is the story that Thomas is telling himself all weekend, on Holy Saturday and on Easter Sunday, when he's trying to be in the peace and the quiet and figure it all out in his own head. Or maybe when he's processing with someone else. He's cooking up this story about why Jesus died and resurrected would come back to life to save all of humankind, to save someone like me. Now, I don't know about you, but sometimes in the midst of these situations where we don't have an explanation, when we weren't there to see it, we start to make up stories in our head. Maybe it's as simple as your kid eats some vegetables at daycare. And the whole way home, as I was driving back, back to our house to tell my husband Joel about the peas and the corn, I thought, well, maybe they put some butter on it for him. Maybe they covered it with ranch dressing. Maybe they gave him a piece of chocolate afterwards as a bribe, and that's how they got him to eat the peas and the corn. We make up these stories, don't we, to try to explain to ourselves how this thing is possible. And there's other times in life, too, when we make up stories. Perhaps you've had a situation at work where a coworker or your boss goes off at you and says something, and you thought, whoa, that just happened. That was totally uncalled for. I don't really understand that. And then you go back to your desk and you start to stew on it a little bit. And as you go about your work, you try to think, oh, maybe it was me. Maybe I did something. And you invent this story in your head about how it's all your fault, right? Maybe you've had an event in your life where someone died or something very tragic happened. And you replay the scene in your head because you don't have all the details. And you start to come up with something really sad or really catastrophic in order to explain away the pain that you've experienced in that moment. There's a woman by the name of Brené Brown who I've been following recently. She's written a couple of books. The one I'm reading right now is called Daring Greatly. She's also got a few TED Talks out on YouTube and a new Netflix original called, I think it's called The Call to Courage. Have you seen it? Have you been following that? Okay. So Brené Brown talks about how in the midst of life, when we go through trials or tribulations, when we're grieving or when we're experiencing pain, our brain has to find a way to cope with that. And through her research as a social worker and as a statistician, she's done experiments and had some trials over the course of her career, and she's found that the brain understands stories. And so that's why we put together narratives. That's why we put together these rational explanations that help us understand how something has come to be. And that's how our brain can cope. That's how we can move on from things we don't understand, from things that are difficult, from things that are hurtful. And she says, one way that we can address these conflicts, these interpersonal conflicts sometimes, is to say to another person, the story I'm telling myself right now in this moment is that you're upset with me because I did something wrong. So let's say your boss goes off at you and slams the door in your face and you go back to your little cubicle and you're trying to do your work and figure it all out. Well, Brené Brown would say the way to address that interpersonal conflict would be to go back to your boss and say, hey, that felt weird. That didn't feel right to me. And the story I'm telling myself is that I did X, Y, or Z. Maybe I left my original on the copy machine, and so when you came to use it last, there was something in your way, and that was an inconvenience. Maybe I made an error on this report, and I didn't catch it in my final proofread. Maybe something else happens that I don't even know, but the story I'm telling myself is that I did something bad, I did something wrong, and that's why you're mad at me. She says, this is the way our brain copes. And in order to get out of some negative cycles where we take on all the guilt, we take on all the shame, we take on all these fears, all this responsibility that isn't ours, we need to confront the person that we're talking to. And that's exactly what we see Jesus do with Doubting Thomas in this story. I don't think Brené Brown was thinking about the Doubting Thomas story when she was writing her research. But this is what happens. Jesus goes up to Thomas a week after he's risen, and he confronts him. And he says, okay, Thomas, you've got questions. I've got answers. You want to look at the marks in my hands? You want to put your hand in my side and feel the place where I was wounded? Go ahead. But don't be faithless. And doubting Thomas, he comes to this realization where the story that he's been telling himself is false. This narrative where Thomas has come up with the idea that he's not worthy of a relationship with Jesus, where he's not worthy of the gift of forgiveness and grace and love that Jesus is trying to offer, where he is not a disciple anymore. And Jesus comes right up to him. He says, don't be faithless. You walked with me and you talked with me and you watched this whole scene unfold. You heard me teaching and preaching and prophesying about all that was to transpire on this holy week. And you know in your heart who I am and what I was called to do and what my earthly ministry was about. So he says, go ahead, touch, see, feel for yourself, use your five senses and experience my presence amongst you again. Go ahead. I'm the same Jesus, but now I am alive forevermore. I reign in heaven and I am with you in this moment and for all of eternity. And that's when Thomas says, my Lord, my God, I get it. The light bulb goes on in his head or something happens. And Thomas says, my Lord, my God, now I see you. Hallelujah. You are alive. In that moment, Thomas starts to understand that the story I'm telling myself, no way. Pish posh, malarkey, that stuff isn't right because I am a child of God. I am a disciple and I am one of the people that Jesus came back to help, to save, to forgive, to love. I am worthy of all of that. I am who Jesus says I am. In this moment, Thomas faces a turning point in his relationship with faith and his relationship with Jesus. The person who is a skeptic, who in his head wants a rational explanation, a linear progression of things that he can see, of things that he can fully grasp in his mind. And now that he's seen, now that he's touched, and now that he's felt, he knows that Jesus is alive, and now he can jump on the bandwagon and start spreading the good news and telling other people about this story. Now he can get to work as a disciple who has seen and who has believed and who knows what's up with this kingdom movement. I wonder how many of us find ourselves in the midst of this act of storytelling. Who, after the Easter celebration last Sunday on April 21st, got all dressed up and enjoyed an amazing worship service and some good food afterwards. And then throughout this week, felt ourselves stumbling around, grasping for straws and asking big questions about who am I? But am I really worthy to receive this gift? Can I actually participate in this grace and in this love and in this mercy? Are my sins forgiven? And if they really are, do I have it in me to forgive others? To participate in the work that Jesus is calling me to do? To love my God and my neighbor? To serve every day with all that I have and all that I am? can I really do that as a person of faith? As someone living in the 21st century in Rochester, Michigan? Miracle of miracles. I want to say, yes, you can. Yes, you can, because even in the midst of the doubts and the storms of life, there are people like Thomas who show us the way back to Jesus, who help us understand that our questions are valid and that God's presence in Jesus Christ is so gracious that we can again draw close to him, that we can again touch those places that we think are real but are wondering about. We can ask those questions and we can get answers because we are in a relationship with Jesus, just like Thomas was. I want to tell you a story from the Old Testament, from the first half of the Bible. And there's a story in there where there's a man named Moses who is helping the Israelite people to cross a large body of water. There's an army, an Egyptian army that's after him. And there's some bad guys in this army who really want to do some harm. And so God tells Moses, you've got to cross the Red Sea. And here's how you're going to do it. You're going to lift your staff and you're going to put it in the water and the sea is going to part. There's going to be a wall of water on either side of you and you can just march right down the middle as if it were the aisle of this church. There's a song about this that we used to sing at Vacation Bible School, you remember? I raise my rod, I stick it in the sand. Okay, you know what? Okay. All right. So there's a story where we fill in some gaps about this because it's called the Midrash. It's where preachers make up the details. And we try to fill in the gaps that we don't understand how this happened. And there's a Midrash story that comes to us from Judaism, from our heritage, where Moses doesn't actually go first because he's the leader of the Israelites, and if he drowns, that's going to get ugly because they still need a leader. The Israelites still need a person to lead them and to get them to the promised land, to get them to safety. And so in this Midrash story where we fill in the gaps, there's a guy named Nashan. And Nashan goes ahead of Moses to test the waters. And so if you can imagine, on the shore of the beach where they're standing, Nashan is back here and Moses is a few feet behind him, and then the rest of the Israelite peoples are back here. Moses says, go ahead. You go first. So Nashan dips his toe in the water. The water's fine. So he starts to wade in. And he wades in up to his ankles and nothing happens. The water doesn't part yet. So he goes in a little deeper. And at this point, the water's up to his knees and still nothing is happening. So he turns back and he's like, Moses. And Moses says, go ahead, go ahead. And so Nashan goes a little deeper, and by this point, the water's up to his hips. And it's not parting, but he's feeling bold. He's feeling courageous. He's wading in these deep waters, and he's a part of this great thing that's going to save all of his people, all of his tribe. So he takes a big, deep breath, and he goes a little deeper, and the water starts to rise up. And at this point, he's treading water. He's in the deep. He can't feel the bottom anymore, and he's swimming. And the water starts to rise. It goes up to his chin. Nothing happens. He turns around. Moses! Hey, guys! They keep urging him on. Because miracle of miracles, they believe that something is going to happen. They believe that God is going to act on their behalf and do something to save them from this Egyptian army that's chasing them down. So Nishan takes another big breath, and the water's up to his chin, but he wades out a little deeper. He treads water. He goes a little deeper. And finally, the water touches the tip of his nose, and bazinga. The walls of the water start to recede. They start to form up all around him. He probably drops a little bit. Midrash, he makes stuff up, right? He drops down a little bit and touches the sandy bottom of the seashore at the Red Sea. And he turns around and he's like, "We did it! We did it! Come on! Let's get out of here!" And the whole tribe, all the Israelite people, and Moses with his staff, follow him. The sea has parted. They can cross into dry land and into safety, into the promised land, to the place where they know they will be safe, where they can be themselves, where they can live their faith, where they will find peace and prosperity. The reason I wanted to tell you this story is because I believe that sometimes, in the midst of our doubts, in the midst of our questions, in the midst of our wonderings and our wanderings along life's journey of faith, we are the people who stand at the shore asking big questions, searching for answers, wondering, where is God and who am I and what am I going to do in the midst of this? And as we use all the boldness and all the courage and all the faith that God has given us, we take small incremental steps towards the place where God is going to work a miracle, where we're going to be brought to a more fuller understanding of what it means to be in a relationship with God and Jesus Christ, where we see ourselves as children of God, as people who are worthy of love, as those people whom Jesus came to teach, to serve, and to save. This week I've been asking some big questions in the midst of my life. As we were preparing this video to show you, I wondered, why, oh God, are there kids, little kids, who look just like mine, living as survivors of abuse and neglect? Why would they experience such trauma and have to go to a place like Methodist Children's Home Society? Why is the church still mired in conflict? Decades of conflict over how we understand ourselves to be inclusive of all people. Why can't we just figure out how to welcome all, how to accept all with love, like Jesus does? And why is the fear of people who are different from us, who are other than us, such that it leads to violent hate crimes and tragic deaths? How are the people in Sri Lanka or in San Diego so much different than I am? And why are we afraid of them? I've got these big questions in the life of my faith, and I don't have all the answers. I don't have all the answers. I've got stories that I've made up that help me cope. But I'm wondering if there's a way that I can engage my faith, if there's a way that I can live my love for Jesus Christ in a deeper way, so that my testimony, so that my witness, so that our collective participation in the ministry and the work of Jesus Christ can overcome some of these obstacles. Moses was able to do it, so maybe we can too. I'm tempted to say, no way, not me. That's a bunch of malarkey, pish posh, when pigs fly. But then I look at these stories, I listen again to the words of a man who doubted everything. Thomas says, I have seen the Lord. All things are possible. He is alive again. He has risen to new life. Maybe so can I. Maybe so can we. Maybe so can you. As you carry with you your questions and your doubts and your fears and your frustrations, may you take courage from a man like Doubting Thomas, who said, I want to go and I want to touch the place in Jesus' hands. I want to feel the place in his sides. I want to ask him all my questions. May you be like the one who was bold enough to engage in his relationship with Jesus. The man of grace, the man of truth, the man who came to show us how to love. Will you pray with me? God, you are amazing. You are so amazing that you sent your son Jesus to be in relationship with us. From him, we learned what it's like to walk and talk with you. And now, as Easter people, we long to continue to show the world what he started. Help us to live into a ministry of love, to be bold and courageous as we make that love known, to share your good news with everyone that you are alive and that those who you came to save look just like the people here at Open Door today. Open us up to be worthy of this great love, to see ourselves as your children, holy and beloved and precious in your sight. And be with us this week as we go from this place so that others might see that love pouring out of us and into the streets. Amen.